The kid was born without a right hand. He was eager to get some trigger time, but Zambrano said he should be a lookout for a while. Everyone called the kid Chueco, or Crooked, what you called the lefty. It was weird that the kid wasn't parked out front like he was supposed to be. Lucky for him, Zambrano didn't know he'd abandoned his post. He must have gone for a coke or something. It didn't matter. Moco didn't need him anyway. He had Gusano, the village idiot. The worm sat in the passenger seat, gaping at the rows and rows of fancy homes like he'd never seen a nice house before. Moco cursed himself every time he brought the slow-witted sicario along, until the shooting started. Idiot or not, the worm was a killing machine. In more than a dozen hits, Moco had never seen him hesitate. It was just getting to that point that was tedious. Gusano turned and blinked like some kind of tree sloth.
Guay, what do you think these houses cost?
Moco just shook his head and got out of the truck. Gusano was like a little kid. If you answered one question, he would only come up with another. The houses were big, though probably not too expensive in the great scheme of things. An FBI agent lived here, after all, and she couldn't be knocking down enough to buy one of the real McMansions that were springing up all over North Dallas. These brick monstrosities had high roofs and wooden privacy fences to keep the neighbors from snooping on one another, but they were pretty much all the same, with a rock wall here or a wood panel there to give off the illusion that the developer had used more than four different blueprints. A wide concrete walking trail ran behind the houses on this street, winding along a low creek choked with cottonwood trees and impenetrable tangles of Mustang grapevines. The developer probably advertised it as a green belt, and the homeowners got a healthy charge in their yearly association dues for the privilege of living next to a swamp that the developer couldn't build on anyway. No, the neighborhood around Buttermilk Circle wasn't exactly wealthy, but it was rich enough that Moco and Gusano couldn't just walk around without looking like they had a reason to be there. A couple of Mexicans pushing lawnmowers for a bunch of white Texans was stereotypical. But Moco wanted to blend in, not climb up the social ladder. It was warm, but Moco had fastened the top button on his western shirt in order to hide most of the Santa Muerte tattoo. Gusano had a similar tattoo, but it was on his back, so a t-shirt was enough to hide his. Moco opened the dented tailgate and slid out two treated 2x6 pieces of lumber before climbing into the bed and guiding the greasy lawnmower down the makeshift ramps. He wasn't even sure the old thing would run. Gusano grabbed a weed eater and the red gas can that contained their guns. As slow as he was, the worm had figured out on his own that a 5-gallon fuel jug could hold two Tech-9 machine pistols, two Glocks, and a break-open shotgun with both barrels sawed down to 10 inches. He'd cut the red plastic with a jigsaw, and then used a piano hinge and a couple hasps to keep his new gun vault closed while he carried it. The hasps were visible, but cops wouldn't even pay attention to a fuel jug. They'd no sooner left the truck than an old guy with a young blonde wife who was way too hot for his fat gut whistled Moco over as he pushed the mower past. The fat guy wanted to know if he had time to take on a new customer. Gusano was already in killing mode and braced beside him, setting the fuel jug on the sidewalk. Moco gave a slight shake of his head, hoping the crazy assassin noticed. In any other circumstance, he would have flipped the guy off, or maybe even beat his ass for disrespecting him with a whistle. But Moco smiled instead and said he'd drop back by when he was done with his present job and set something up. The lady, who obviously had better sense than her asshole husband, kept tugging on his hand to try to get him to follow her inside. The old man finally relented, listening to his wife for a moment, and then said not to worry about it. Moco watched them walk inside and made a mental note of the address. The couple had gotten a good long look at him. He'd have to think about coming back and tying up that loose end. Moco chuckled to himself as the blonde peeked out a crack in her door one last time to give him the eye. Yeah, he'd come back all right. It would be fun. Moko pushed the lawnmower up the sidewalk until they reached the FBI lady's place. Gusano read the number on the mailbox. It was mottled red brick to match the house. 2348. This is it, then, Moko said, feeling the tightness in his lungs that he felt before every hit. A large ceramic frog squatted among neatly trimmed shrubs along the concrete porch. Fresh wood chips covered the manicured area under a newly planted pecan tree in the front yard. This lady cop had obviously already hired another company to take care of her yard work. Moko felt a pang of professional jealousy, and then remembered he wasn't there to do her lawn. He'd expected to see an unmarked cop car out front, but the driveway was empty. The curtains moved a little, and he caught a sliver of light, so she had to be home. She'd probably just put the car in the garage. He studied the house as they approached. The gate to her backyard privacy fence stood open. Moko figured FBI agents probably traveled too much to have a dog. But the open gate calmed him nonetheless. Gusano stopped on the sidewalk before they turned to walk to the front door.
Can I go first?
Moko didn't want to appear too eager. The worm might mention it later, and the boss might think he was a coward. But the truth was, he didn't mind at all if Gusano was first at the door. Lady cops died just like everyone else, but this one was certain to try to shoot back. The curtains had moved, so for all Moko knew, she was sighted in on him with her finger on the trigger. Being a cop, she was probably paranoid enough to have a shotgun by the front door. Hell, Moko wasn't even a cop, and he had a shotgun by his front door.
If you really want to go first, he said, I guess that's okay.
Gusano hefted the weed-eater in a salute of gratitude and turned to walk quickly toward the door. Moko followed, standing off to the side toward the garage, clear of the line of fire in case the lady cop decided to go all Rambo on them. Gusano set the fuel jug on the concrete porch between them and then reached down to flip the hasps, lifting the handle to reveal the guns inside. He made sure the Tech-9s were clear of the other weapons, butts pointed up, and then rang the doorbell. A few moments later, there was a shuffle of movement inside. The door opened a crack. Lawn service, Gusano said, throwing his weight against the door at the same moment he came up with the Tech-9. A shadowy figure fell away under the assault. There was a short, yelping scream as Gusano rushed in, hitting the door with such force that it rebounded off the wall and slammed shut behind him, leaving Moko standing outside on the porch. Three quick pops followed, muffled by the heavy door. Moko threw a quick glance over his shoulder. The sprinkler across the street still hissed. Kids still played soccer in the nearby field. With his own gun tucked in close to his waist, shielding it from view of passers-by, Moko reached for the door handle. Gusano opened it first, sticking his head out through the crack as if he wanted to spare Moko a look inside.
Hey, he said, I think we might have a problem.
What?
Este es un hombre rubio, he said.
Moko groaned and shouldered his way into the house. Sure enough, Gusano, the worm, had just shot a man with blonde hair.
Is anyone else in the house?
Right, Gusano grimaced.
We should check.
Moko thought about killing the idiot right then and there, but then there wouldn't be anyone to blame when they told the boss. Instead, he stepped over the dead man, and the two would-be hitmen searched the rest of the house. The blonde man turned out to live alone.
Where is she?
Moko said to himself while he stood over the dead man. He knew better than to engage Gusano with an important question. All three rounds from the worm's Tech-9 had impacted him center chest, killing him in seconds. There was a wallet on the kitchen counter, next to some keys and a loaded Ruger LC-9 pistol. Moko hoped against hope that this was another FBI agent, maybe the lady cop's boyfriend or something. He cursed when he found an ID card from a nearby mortgage company that identified the dead man as Aaron Bennett. Gusano just stood and stared at the man he'd killed, nodding smugly as if he were proud of his handiwork. Moko glanced around the living room. Every piece of art, all the furniture, the photos above the mantel, all had to do with hunting and fishing. The few photos of women were of Bennett with the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders, or family shots with his mother. No females lived in this house. Moko scratched his head.
I don't get it. This is the house. 2348 Buttermilk Circle.
Gusano gave a sideways look.
This is Buttermilk Place.
Moko's hand tightened around the butt of his pistol. His head began to shake.
Are you shitting me? You knew we were at the wrong address?
The worm shrugged.
I was wondering why we came to Buttermilk Place.
We need to go, Moko said through clenched teeth.
Did you touch anything?
No, Gusano said.
You think I'm stupid?
Moko didn't answer. The boss was going to hack them up alive with a chainsaw. But there was nothing they could do about it now. Too many people had seen them to risk another hit right now. But Moko was sure of one thing. There was only one way he could rectify his mistake. He had to find the FBI lady and kill her.
Chapter 32. Helen Reed, Hendley Associates' chief pilot, battled white-knuckle downdrafts and a torrential downpour to bring the Gulfstream 550 in for a long landing, touching down farther along runway 29 so she could scoot out of the way of an Aerolíneas Argentinas Airbus coming in behind her on final approach. A ground controller with excellent English got her off the runway quickly and guided her to the northeast corner of Buenos Aires's Ministro Pistarini International Airport, where she parked at the General Aviation Terminal. Jack and the other campus operators were relieved to be back on terra firma and were packed and ready to go by the time she set the parking brake. The ownership of the Hendley jet was a matter of open record, but Argentines considered their country an extremely worthwhile destination for tourist travel, so the operators would just declare the purpose of their trip was pleasure and claim it was a company getaway. The team traveled with passports issued by the State Department with all the appropriate biometrics for their cover identities. It was one of the benefits of having friends in extremely high places. Argentina's kidnapping rates had dropped some in recent years, but the son of the President of the United States made for an awfully tempting target. Argentine Immigration and Customs required those arriving via private aircraft to carry all luggage inside the terminal for scanning and inspection while the aircraft remained locked behind a secure fence, which made bringing in the firearms problematic. Chavez solved the issue by having the pilots report a problem with an oil pressure gauge. This necessitated a move to the nearby maintenance hangar, where Adara and Lizanne could pop in and retrieve the handguns and comms gear. The appropriate amount of exposed leg was still one of the most useful social engineering mechanisms in the world. The women were much less likely to be challenged, considering the Latin machismo of the country. Even so, they would tuck the pistols under their clothing just to be on the safe side. Less than 20 minutes after they touched down, the team carried their bags out the front doors of the General Aviation Terminal and sprinted through the late afternoon downpour to locate the three rental cars that were supposed to be staged outside. The plan was for Adara and Lizanne to wait with the pilots and grab the guns once the Gulfstream was towed to the maintenance hangar, while Ding, Midas, and Jack took the other two cars to check into their rooms at the Hotel Panamericano downtown. Except there was only one rental car, a tiny orange Renault Clio hatchback. Lizanne whipped out her cell phone like it was a weapon. With her black hair plastered to her cheeks, she stood in the driving rain and set about chastising the rental car company in a mixture of Spanish, Arabic, and English for making her look bad. No plans survived first contact. Shit happened. And luckily this screw-up didn't cost the team anything but wet clothes and time. Jack couldn't help but think her handling of the situation was pretty damned impressive. Someone at the rental car company finally owned up to the mistake and promised to deliver the two larger cars to the hotel. Chavez, Midas, and Jack would cab it to the Panamericano with the bulk of the luggage. The pilots would drop Adara and the weapons off later and then return to their hotel nearer the airport with Lisanne. Clark had been clear that he didn't want them near any kind of surveillance operation, no matter how much Lisanne offered to help, which she did. A lot. They were crossing the line by having her help retrieve the pistols and comms gear, but that couldn't be helped unless they wanted to go in naked. Chavez and Midas rode together in one cab, while Jack, who spoke only enough Spanish to order a beer, piled into another one by himself with the rest of the luggage. His cabbie was an avuncular man named Rodrigo. Rodrigo, who had sandy hair and a philosophical bent, started speaking the moment Jack's door slammed shut. It was rush hour, and the Autopista Luis Dejepiane was bumper to bumper and door to door. Drivers appeared to pay no attention to the lane markings or the rain, and oozed forward in a magma flow of steaming gridlock. Periodically, a motorcycle would find a gap and roar between the slower-moving cars, splitting lanes. Sometimes they missed the side mirrors. Sometimes they did not. In the first 5 miles, Jack counted at least a half-dozen billboards displaying a variety of beautiful and long-legged women in classy clothing that, as far as he could tell, advertised various clinics that removed unwanted body hair. He would have joked with Midas about it, but then he considered all the crazy crap hawked on billboards in the United States and thought better of it. Inching toward a toll booth, Rodrigo pulled a 100-peso note from his pocket. He must have seen Jack looking from the large bill to the sign above the booth that said he was in the lane for exact change. "No one pays attention to the signs," Rodrigo said in a slow but earnest voice. "The price of toll changes every week or two." He glanced in the rearview mirror. "Inflation in my country, it is..." He held his hand in front of his face, fingers together in the gesture used to explain something important. "It is... subir como pedo de buzo. How do you say? It rises like the fart of a scuba diver." Ryan wanted to chuckle at the imagery of bubbles shooting toward the surface, but the look on Rodrigo's face said the euphemism was no laughing matter. They continued through the toll booth after paying, inching down the autopista in the heavy traffic. Rodrigo used the time to give Ryan a crash course in Argentina, enlightening him on everything from the economy. He had to pay his mortgage in U.S. dollars to the beauty of Iguazu Falls. Ryan and everyone else in the world simply had to see this place at least once. In a tediously slow but earnest voice, Rodrigo went on to declare that Argentine beef was the most delicious. Argentine women were beautiful beyond all description, especially when dancing the tango, and Argentine footballers possessed a superhuman talent at the game. Ryan was an Arsenal fan, but he kept quiet about that, knowing football. Soccer, to Americans, was a touchy subject in many parts of the world. Argentine fans often seemed to treat the act of simply attending a match as a blood sport. Rodrigo continued, "God gave Argentina the most beautiful rivers in all the world. He blessed Argentina with incredible mountains and fruits that are sweet above all others. Here in Argentina, God has planted fields that yield bushels of grain and endless pampas of grass, filled with herds of fat cattle and fine horses." Just then the driver of the car ahead of the taxi rolled down his window and tossed a full bag of trash onto the wet roadway. A piece of sopping wet paper flew up and stuck to the cab's windshield, forcing Rodrigo to roll down his window and reach around to remove it. The cabbie smoothed his sandy hair with a rain-soaked hand and glanced at Jack in the rearview mirror. "And then, God messed it all up by putting the Argentines here." The two cabs arrived within moments of each other, dropping Ryan, Chavez, and Midas at the Panamericano on Carlos Pellegrini, a short walk from the city's famous obelisk on a small one-way street that ran adjacent to the Greenbelt and the 14-lane-wide Avenida Nuevo de Julio. Ryan retrieved the luggage from the back of the taxi and paid the 700-peso fare, around 40 U.S. dollars. Rodrigo nodded and wished him well in a droning voice that sounded as if the cabbie were certain something ominous was going to befall him. Ostensibly, the Panamericano was a five-star hotel, and its limestone facade and turn-of-the-century signage looked welcoming enough after the long trip south. But it had just enough sketchy online reviews to make it unlikely the campus team would run into anyone they were supposed to be watching. Jack stacked the bags on a cart and looked at his watch, and then at Chavez. "What's the plan?"
"Argentines don't eat until after 8. We'll do some foot recon, but if we want to get a true picture of the place, we should wait to eat."
Midas chuckled. "You're just scared of Adara."
"Well," Chavez gave a mock shudder, "she does spend a hell of a lot of time doing CrossFit."
3 hours later, 6 blocks to the north of the hotel and 7 blocks west of Avenida Nuevo de Julio, an attractive brunette named Amanda Salazar sat at a table at the back of the Parisha Aires Criollos restaurant with her friend Beatrice, an equally attractive blonde. A set of rawhide boleadoras, a weighted throwing weapon of stone and rawhide, hung from the wall above them with other assorted gaucho paraphernalia. Multitasking, or at least multitasking skillfully, was impossible, so the young women divided their responsibilities. Amanda's job was to laugh between sips of La Azul Malbec and bat her impossibly long eyelashes at the attentive older man who waited on their table. She wore her shoulder-length hair down and loose. Beatrice wore hers up, pulled back with unseen pins that made her look older, though at 26 she was actually the younger of the two. Beatrice did her share of smiling as well, but she left flirting with the waiter to her partner. Under the table, the blonde concentrated on her work, wiggling the face off the heating vent with the tip of her toe. Parisha Aires Criollos was an upscale restaurant with gaucho decor, tile floors, and crisp white tablecloths. As the name implied, it served Argentine cuisine and grilled meat with a distinctly Spanish flair. The long tablecloths, aided by Amanda's entrancing laugh, helped to conceal the tedious work removing the vent cover. Amanda and Beatrice were dressed in stylish blouses and skirts, each wearing just enough makeup and jewelry to make them attractive, but not especially memorable. Classy dress was the norm in Buenos Aires, and dressing down would have garnered more attention. Each woman carried a brown leather briefcase, leading people to think they were lawyers, or perhaps some other brand of young professional women who had decided to grab some dinner before they got an early start at some of the local clubs. Tonight they had chosen to arrive exactly at 8 p.m. The restaurant was busy enough that all eyes would not be focused on them, but not so crowded that they would have trouble finding a table in the area they wanted. They'd come in for a late lunch 2 days earlier, locating the area where they would have to sit in order to accomplish their mission. The area near the bar, it seemed, was reserved for private functions. But if no such function was scheduled, guests were seated here when all the other tables were filled. A visit to the restrooms during their lunchtime visit took the young women near enough to locate the vent cover and devise their plan. Either woman was capable of removing a vent or captivating the emotions of all manner of man or woman. They had met Franco, the waiter, on this previous visit. Whether he intended to or not, the man's extra attention to Amanda's water glass made it obvious that he was smitten with the beautiful brunette. He took her order first and smiled his thin smile when he gave her his suggestion for just the right pairing of wine and food. Far from being jealous, Beatrice had considered this a happy circumstance and allowed it to dictate their respective duties the following night. She would much rather deal with high explosives than the attentions of an overly attentive waiter with greasy hair. Tonight, Amanda had caught Franco's eye across the long and narrow dining room as soon as they came through the door. He rushed forward, still carrying a tray of dirty glasses he'd just cleaned off one of the tables, greeting her effusively. She pointed out the area near the bar and begged to sit there. Like most instances where women pre-planned their dealings with men, it was all too easy. The scouting visit on the previous evening revealed the heating vents were held in place by friction rather than screws. In theory, this should have made it easier to remove. Beatrice kicked off her shoe as soon as they sat down, going straight to work with her toe. The metal louver appeared to be glued in place at first, but she finally got it to budge a little by pushing the face back and forth, rather than trying to simply hook it with her nail and pull it out. Eventually, she was able to wiggle it out. She felt the metal and surrounding boxy collar slide free from the wood panel at the same moment Franco chose to visit their table. Beatrice was just able to catch the piece of metal with her bare foot and wedge it against the wall. The waiter smiled at Amanda, paying Beatrice no attention at all, and placed a platter containing their picada on the table. The girl's accents gave away the fact that they were not from Argentina, and Franco felt it a duty to explain the bits of baked cheese and sliced meat people from his beloved country ate before a main meal. Beatrice balanced the grate in place, keeping her face passive while the arch of her foot began to spasm and cramp. Amanda noted her friend's discomfort and asked Franco to suggest another wine for them to try. He scurried off to find something just right for the beautiful señorita who had chosen to return to his restaurant. Beatrice sighed with relief when she let the grate slip to the floor and come to rest on top of her foot. Franco was a waiter and therefore not trained in the art of espionage or tradecraft, but surely any man with his pudgy physique and halting demeanor would suspect that two attractive women he'd only just met might have ulterior motives. One of them might perhaps be trying to distract him while her friend placed a bomb inside the wall of his restaurant. Beatrice gave a whispered scoff, shaking her head at Amanda. Hope. It is every man's demise. Amanda raised her eyebrows, the facial equivalent of a shrug. And the downfall of most women, she said. The bomb itself was small, made from military-grade RDX. A key component of C4 was cyclotrimethylene trinitramine. The name was a mouthful, so the British developers simply called it Research Department Explosive. This particular batch of RDX was manufactured at a munitions plant outside Islamabad. Pakistani operatives were fond of the stuff, and had used it to great effect in bombings against India and the West. Motor oil or some other carbon-based product was often mixed with the explosive to mask the material's origin. Amanda and Beatrice left it plain. They wanted investigators to know the RDX came from Pakistan. Their briefcase device contained half a kilo of the plasticized material, a bit of PETN, and a blasting cap with a detonator attached to an arming device, and then a mobile phone, also from Pakistan. As the two women talked, Beatrice used her foot to lift and push her briefcase into the space behind the vent cover. It took only a moment, and stooping slightly, she was able to replace the cover before Franco returned with a bottle of Schrader Merlot from Patagonia. To his shame, Amanda said she preferred the earlier Malbec, and he slunk away with the open bottle. Fairly giddy with the success of this portion of their mission, the women dug into the contents of the picada. Beatrice absent-mindedly twirled a lock of blonde hair over her ear as she began to peruse the menus, getting down to the business of deciding what to have for dinner. It turned out that placing a bomb was very good for one's appetite. Neither woman noticed the tall, bearded man with the fit-looking blonde. The well-dressed couple stopped just inside the front door, both scanning the now crowded restaurant as if looking for just the perfect table. Chapter 33 Mocha almost hit his head on the roof of his S10 pickup when his mobile phone began to buzz in the front pocket of his jeans. He nearly ran a fat woman in a green minivan off the road. She flipped him off, which would have normally caused him to chase her down, if only to scare her for disrespecting him. Instead, he took a deep breath and imagined the woman's head sitting on a fence post. Maybe later. That calmed him down some. The phone buzzed again, but Moko let it. He was terrified that it might be Zambrano, checking on the status of the hit. The sicario had felt like he was about to throw up ever since Gusano wasted the wrong dude. Not because he felt any remorse at Aaron Bennett's death, but because he knew that Zambrano would very literally set him on fire if they didn't kill the FBI bitch today. This Callahan puta had her federal fingers all over the boss's North Texas operation, and Zambrano had made it clear. He wanted those fingers floating in a jar of tequila on his mantle by the time he went to bed. Pretty nail polish and all. The danger of being stopped with the guns inside the plastic gas jug post-shooting scared the shit out of Moco. He'd never wanted a joint so bad in his life. Gusano just sat in the passenger seat of the S-10 and listened to his playlist. Nothing ever bothered him. Stupid bastard. Special Agent Kelsey Callahan lived alone, but Moco fully expected her to be armed. She was sure to put up a fight, so he couldn't very well get rid of all the guns if he wanted to get the job done. Still, he left the kid washing her house and did a quick run over to Lake Levan to dump the Tech-9 so there wouldn't be any ballistics to match the bullets in Aaron Bennett's chest. There was a metric shit ton of work to do if they were going to find their way around Gusano's mistake. Moco had started saying it that way in his head right after the shooting, throwing the blame to the worm by calling it Gusano's mistake. Maybe the boss would believe it, if he said it enough times. Moco leaned back from the steering wheel to dig out the phone in the middle of the fourth ring. It was Chueco, the kid who was sitting on Callahan's house. "Some guy just drove up and went to her door," Chueco said. "Tall, dark beard. Looks like a tough dude. She let him in, so I guess she knows him." Moco mulled over this new information. A new guy would add a wrinkle to the problem. But it might even help. If he was a boyfriend, maybe his presence would mess with Callahan's mind, make her easier to take. He had a sudden thought. "Is this guy a cop?" "I don't know about him," Chueco said, "but about 5 minutes after he got here, a bunch of cops showed up on the next street over. There must be a dozen marked cars. Must be something bad." The kid had no idea. "Sit tight," Moco said. "We'll be parked at the 7-Eleven up the street. Let us know when the cops clear out, or if Callahan leaves." "She left already," Chueco said. Moco stomped on the gas. There was always the risk of getting pulled over, but he figured every cop within 15 miles was already at Buttermilk Place. "What do you mean, gone? Did the guy go with her?" "He did," the kid said. "They got in her car and followed another cop over to the commotion on the next street." "Want me to get closer and see what's going on?" "No," Moco snapped, maybe a little too quickly. Gusano looked over at him, wires hanging from his ears, head bobbing to his tunes. "Just stay where you can see her car," Moco said. "Call me when she moves again." "Ta bueno, bye." Chueco ended the call now that he had his assignment. Moco eased off the accelerator, feeling an unseen hand tighten around his gut. This was all coming down too fast for him to process. Damn, he really needed some weed. Special Agent Kelsey Callahan stood over the body of the man she'd never met and clenched her fists until she was afraid her nails might tear through the blue nitrile gloves. Two crime scene technicians from the Garland, Texas Police Department busied themselves placing yellow plastic markers on the floor, enumerating the location of 3 spent shell casings and several boot prints on the polished slate floor around the entry. A uniformed officer photographed the interior of the house, while a handful of other officers combed the yard and interviewed the neighbors for any clue as to who had murdered Aaron Bennett. One of the uniforms, a sergeant named Morris, had served on the Crimes Against Children Task Force for a couple years and knew Callahan lived nearby. He'd snapped to the similar address and taken it upon himself to inform her of the homicide, much to the chagrin of Detective Fran Little, who made it extremely clear that she didn't want the feeble eyes getting their fed gunk on her homicide case. Detective Little hitched up the thighs of her 5'11 khakis and squatted on the other side of the body with the digital camera. "You know this guy?" she asked, without looking up. "Never met him," Callahan said. "It's obvious what happened, though." The detective stood, pushing a lock of straw-colored hair off her forehead with the back of her gloved hand. "And how's that?" Callahan bit her tongue to keep from saying what she really wanted to say.
I guess there's a chance this guy has gambling debts or a jilted lover, but there's a more obvious answer. This is 2348 Buttermilk Place. I live at 2348 Buttermilk Circle.
Detective Little raised both eyebrows, like Callahan was some kid she was trying to humor.
I'd rather look at the evidence in total, if you don't mind. I'm pointing out all the evidence, Callahan said.
If you don't better check yourself, Detective Little said. It sounds like you're about to give me an ultimatum, and I don't respond well to those.
Callahan closed her eyes and took a slow breath.
I was going to say, if you don't see it, I can spell it out for you.
Detective Little scoffed. Well, ain't that just downright neighborly of you? Makes me feel a lot better.
The only motive to kill Aaron Bennett is that he happens to live at an address similar to mine.
Caruso touched Callahan on the elbow to guide her gently away. The shrinks at Quantico taught that this was one of the most unthreatening places to touch most people. But apparently Callahan was not most people. She jerked away and glared as though she might punch him in the face.
Look, Detective Little said, we will get around to checking with any people who want you dead. I can imagine that list will be a long one. But if I'm not doing my job in the order you deem fit, well, I got plenty of more important things to do than stand around here and argue. Be my guest if you want to take over. I'll have my guys out of here so fast your head will spin, lady.
Callahan turned as if to walk away, then wheeled.
You listen, Fran. I'm not trying to piss on your leg. I'm merely pointing out that the person who killed this guy was really after me. When you snap to that fact, give me a call.
Moco needed weed so bad, but he couldn't chance it with so many cops swarming all over the place. Luckily, there was enough hash oil hidden in the door panel of his truck for two dabs. Making the hash oil was tricky business, requiring him to boil off the liquid butane he used to extract it from the buds. High heat and butane didn't go well together, so the process took forever. When he was finished, he had an amber, honey-like substance packed with THC.
Moco liked to put a little dab of the sticky stuff on the end of a nail and smoke it. The buzz helped him think straight. Problem was, that would be almost as noticeable as smoking a joint, and he didn't want to go there. Dabs tasted like shit if you ate them straight. But he had a plan. A lighter, a metal spoon, and a little bit of coconut oil he kept in the glove box would help the dabs slide down quickly, even if it didn't do much about the taste. He wedged the spoon in the crack of the center console to hold it, and then added a dab, about the size of a Tic Tac, with a half teaspoon of coconut oil. He was just in the middle of mixing the concoction with the point of his pocket knife when his phone began to vibrate again.
Hold this, he said, passing the mixture of dab and coconut oil to Gusano, who took his earbuds out and blinked stupidly.
Don't spill it.
Gusano promptly stuck the spoon in his mouth and slurped down the whole thing.
Moco wanted to stab the idiot, and would have had he not needed help. He punched him in the shoulder instead.
What? The worm said. I thought you gave it to me.
Moco shook his head and answered the phone. It was Chueco again.
She's coming your way, the kid said. That tough-looking dude with the beard is with her.
Follow her, Moco said. He hung up and then looked across the seat at Gusano, still fuming over the stolen hash oil. He spoke through clenched teeth, hardly able to sit still.
You son of a bitch.
Gusano nodded at the crumpled piece of plastic wrap in Moco's lap.
What? You got another one? I'll help you make some more after we kill the FBI lady.
You better, Moco said, still glaring.
He peeled back the plastic and bit off the rest of the hash oil, clenching his teeth at the bitterness. Eating it straight wouldn't give him nearly as good a high as when it was mixed with oil. But it would have to be enough. Callahan's unmarked expedition rolled by the 7-Eleven, and Moco threw the pickup in gear. At least he was starting to get the dab sweats. Maybe he'd be thinking straight enough to kill the right person this time. Chapter 34. The thing Magdalena Rojas first noticed about Ernie Pacheco was his teeth. This would have pleased him had she mentioned it, because he'd paid a lot of money for them. She remembered that her father had had a nice smile, but this man they called Matarife was different. His perfect smile was starkly mismatched to the rest of his craggy, misshapen face. She'd heard he was injured in a bar fight, but whatever the cause, his flat nose looked like it had been melted and then smeared above his lip. An asterisk-shaped scar puckered the sunken flesh under his left eye. The ear on that same side was a mass of scar tissue. He kept his dark hair pulled back in a thick man bun. He seemed to believe the style anchored him to a more youthful appearance, but Magdalena thought it just called attention to the severity of the mess that he called a face. Oddly, while all those who followed him were adorned with images of La Santa Muerte, Matarife, the self-professed leader of her cult, did not have a single tattoo on his body. Magdalena had met the man many times, but he never paid for her, even when she'd belonged to Dorian or Parrot. He took her just the same, always pretending like it was all her idea and that she should be happy because he was saving her from the other guys. It pissed off Parrot, but he never said anything. He just chopped her when Matarife left. He sat across from her now, naked, chewing on a bite of rare steak and gesturing at her with his knife as he spoke. He liked to eat dinner without his clothes. Magdalena didn't care. Like most things that had to do with sex that didn't cause her too much pain, she'd grown numb to it. But he hit her if she didn't giggle and raise her eyebrows up and down and pretend she was impressed. She had seen many naked men, and apart from the black hair that covered his body like a wild ape, there was nothing impressive about him. He nudged aside a small silver cross and picked a bit of fallen meat from his matted chest hair, looking at it for a moment to see what it was, before popping it between his perfect teeth. He pointed with the steak knife again.
"I should tell you of Matarife's trip to Colombia," he said. "It was very dangerous."
He boasted a great deal for someone who didn't care about impressing her. She supposed he was bragging to himself. He liked to speak of things that made him seem handsome and tough and smart. Magdalena thought he was none of these things, except perhaps tough, considering the scars on his face. Well, maybe he was a little bit smart, or else he would not have been so rich. He wasn't smart enough to take her straight to Zambrano's like he was supposed to. That was for sure. Ernie Pacheco was a cruel man, but Zambrano was crueler and would kill him for disobedience. Probably. He looked at her with his narrow pig eyes, the left one even narrower because of the scar.
"You're not gonna eat? You haven't touched anything?"
She faked a smile.
"I am not hungry. You want another beer?"
She hoped he'd eaten so much meat and drunk enough beer that he'd just fall asleep. Guys did that sometimes, so she always asked them if they wanted more. He pushed back from the table and clapped his hands, rubbing them together like a housefly. The man bun, the strange eyes. He looked a lot like a fly, she thought. He rubbed his hairy belly and gave a long sigh.
"Hey," he said, "I got an idea that will help us get in the mood."
Magdalena groaned inside, struggling to keep up the fake smile. He put his hand behind her back and gave her a shove. It didn't knock her over, but there was no doubt that she had no choice about going to the bedroom.
"We'll watch one of my movies," he said, chuckling a little.
He gave her another shove, harder this time.
"It'll be fun. You might even know some of the stars."
Chapter 35. Dominic Caruso accelerated Kelsey Callahan's bureau-issued Ford Expedition down the on-ramp of the President George Bush Turnpike, heading toward Plano.
He'd insisted on driving, despite Callahan's objections. She already suspected him of being complicit in the murder of a couple cartel members, though she hadn't said much about it. But the run-in with the Garland PD detective had left her leg bouncing like the needle on a sewing machine. Caruso considered talking to her about the incident, but quickly decided that he was in mortal danger of getting his head bitten off. Turf wars notwithstanding, whoever killed Aaron Bennett had come gunning for Callahan. The fact that the killer or killers went to Buttermilk Place instead of Buttermilk Circle gave Caruso a little peek into their intellect and psyche. But in his experience, assassins hit the wrong person more than a quarter of the time. Two of the first fugitive cases during his early career, when he worked for the FBI more than just on paper, had been victims of mistaken identity. In both cases, the killers had realized the screw-up and rectified it in short order. Caruso checked the rearview mirror several times a minute as he drove, knowing that the people who wanted Callahan dead were very likely back there now. Traffic was heavy and it was getting dark, which would work to Caruso's favor if he needed to avoid an attack, but made it easy for any bad actors to blend into the sea of headlights behind him. He took the exit toward Campbell Road, watching to see if anyone followed. Three sets of lights came off behind him. He turned left to pass back under the freeway, but instead of continuing down Campbell, he camped out at the green light, squirting through just as it turned red to make a quick left back up the frontage road to the east, paralleling the turnpike back in the direction they'd come from. No one behind him did anything crazy to follow. Callahan turned to look at him, but said nothing. She obviously knew he was working to shake off any unseen tales. Caruso glanced across the dim interior of the expedition. "How long since you've had anything to eat?" "I'm fine," Callahan said. Caruso decided to press the issue. "Seriously, how long?" She gave a dismissive shrug. "I don't know. I had that coffee for breakfast." "Before that?" Caruso said. "I've been with you since before 7 this morning, and I haven't seen you eat so much as a breath mint. You're starting to look a little hollow around the cheeks." Callahan beat her head against the headrest. "We've known each other for what, 26 hours? I don't think you're allowed to call me too skinny." "What?" Caruso grinned. "You've called me bastard, son of a bitch, and asshole, along with pretty much every other name in the book over that same period." "I did not." "Not even in your brain?" Callahan laughed out loud. "That doesn't count." Caruso turned his head to look at her as he drove. "So you admit it?" "I admit that I may have thought one or two unflattering things about you." "Good," Caruso said. "Then I'll admit I am hungry. Can we please get something to eat?" Moko pounded his hands against the steering wheel, craning his head left and right in search of the lady cop's expedition. He cursed Gusano for eating the dab. He'd been forced to eat the rest of his hash oil plain. Without the benefit of the coconut oil, it wasn't doing a damn bit of good. Taillights flashed and blinked in a confusing river of red. Oncoming headlights blinded him. She'd gotten away from him, and now the boss was going to set him on fire, or pump him full of so much dope he wouldn't pass out while the guys cut his feet off with a chainsaw. This could not be happening. The worm sat with his nose pressed against the passenger window, head bobbing to his tunes. He held one of the Glocks in his lap, which was the only thing keeping Moko from shooting the stupid bastard in the back of the head. Moko's mobile phone buzzed as he merged back onto the turnpike. It was the kid.
"What?"
"You want me to wait outside or follow them in?" Moko's stomach did a flip.
"What are you talking about?"
"They're going into the restaurant," the kid said.
"Want me to sit on her car?"
"What restaurant?" Moko shot a look at Gusano. "Never mind. Just tell me where you're at. We'll meet you outside." "Texas Roadhouse," the kid said. "I'm on the north side of the parking lot."
"Wait there for us."
Moko ended the call. He turned to Gusano, suddenly feeling as if he might make it through the night without getting his feet sawed off.
Even his anger at the worm began to fade. Get ready, my friend. Gusana raised an eyebrow. Are you certain we are going to the correct restaurant? His tone said he was serious. 10 minutes after he cut back under the turnpike at Brand Road, Caruso sat with his back to the wall across the booth from Callahan, watching her slather cinnamon butter on a Texas Roadhouse hot roll. She spoke with her hands as much as her voice, and was imbued with such energy and fervor that her red hair bounced in time to her words. The food animated her, and she appeared to forget about Detective Little and the dead bodies at Matarife's ranch. 2 hot rolls down, Callahan suddenly put both hands flat on the table and looked across at Caruso with narrow eyes. You know why they're trying to kill me, don't you? Caruso started to say something, but she cut him off. It's not because I've gotten into their business, if that's what you were going to say. I muck up people's illegal criminal enterprises all the time. Okay, Caruso shrugged. Enlighten me. Callahan gave a tired smile. It's because they don't think I'm playing by the rules. But you are. Caruso did a quick scan of the room before making eye contact to show he was listening. Ah, Callahan said, but they don't know that. Your buddy John, or whatever his name is, grabs Flacco and pressures information out of him and then blows away Matarife's yard help and his girlfriend, naked in the swimming pool. Except your friend's pretty good at staying hidden, so they can't find him. I'm the face of the investigation, so they're coming after me. Caruso put his hands on the table as well, an interrogation tool called mirroring. She'd be familiar with it, but he did it anyway. I want you to think about something, he said, keeping his voice low. Do you honestly believe that someone who calls himself the slaughterer and sells human beings at online auctions or murders them on camera really gives 2 shits if you play by the rules? I doubt he even sees any rules. Callahan shrugged. Maybe not, she said. I thought it might get you to spill something useful about your friend John. What was his name again? I know he's gone off the reservation. And when this is over, it'll be my job to stop him. Our job, really. Nice try, Caruso said. I need to hit the restroom. If the waitress comes back while I'm gone, order me a bone-in ribeye, medium rare, and broccoli. Callahan nodded, eyeing the last roll. Are you going to eat that? The restrooms were to the right, but Dominic Caruso turned left, heading for the front door. There were several emergency exits, but there was only 1 public entrance to the restaurant, and he'd made sure he had a table that watched the door. It wasn't likely, but anyone who was bound and determined to kill Callahan might decide to come in through the kitchen. Caruso decided he'd do a quick check of the parking lot to look for anything out of the ordinary. Their waitress caught him as he was walking past a big barrel of peanuts in an alcove just inside the front door. Everything all right, hon? The young woman with wide hips and a black ponytail asked. Caruso held up the keys to the expedition. I forgot something in the car, he said. I think my friend could use some more hot rolls, though. The cowbell on the front door clanged, and Caruso saw the reflections of 2 men in the plate glass window as they entered behind him. The waitress said something about getting the rolls for Callahan, but Dominic stopped listening as soon as he saw the Santa Muerte tattoo on the reflection of the man in the lead. He was short and stocky, with the brim of a tattered denim baseball cap pulled low over a flat nose. The man behind him was taller and staggered a little, like he might have had a bit too much to drink. Both wore their shirt tails untucked, a convenient way to hide handguns. Caruso kept his back to the men and his head down. It's a 45-minute wait, the hostess told the 2 men, obviously hoping to persuade the shady newcomers to go somewhere else. That's okay, the man with a flat nose said. We're meeting friends. We'll find them. Caruso waited for both men to walk past before holding a finger to his lips so the waitress could see. When they were out of earshot, he leaned in and said, I'm FBI. Call 911 and tell them there are federal agents on scene.
What? Do it now,
Caruso hissed. He reached inside his shirt collar to pull out a gold FBI badge, letting it hang from a chain around his neck. Ahead of him, the men worked their way around the bar area, stopping to look at each booth as they went by. Callahan was on the other side of the restaurant, short enough that she was hidden behind a high wooden barrier. Caruso had taken the gunfighter seat, so her back was to the door. He estimated the men would be on top of her in less than a half a minute. He rested his right hand on the .40 caliber Glock 22 in the holster under his jacket. There was no way to know how many off-duty cops were in the restaurant. He didn't want to draw the pistol too early, for fear of a blue-on-blue shooting. He took out his cell phone with his left hand, glancing down just long enough to punch in Callahan's number. It went immediately to voicemail. Caruso cursed under his breath. 30 feet ahead, the guy with the flat nose motioned to his partner, who had stopped to watch a soccer game above the bar. The taller man shrugged, swayed on his feet a little, and then the two men turned down the row of booths where Callahan sat. She was in the back corner, the one that had given Caruso the wall, which meant that they'd get to her last. But it also meant she wouldn't see them until they were almost in her lap. Caruso took slow breaths, planning his next move. The wall beyond the two bad guys made for a decent enough backstop. But the booths on either side were packed with people. A little boy climbed in and out of the booth where his parents sat and chased crayons that rolled across the floor. Caruso was an excellent shot, but little kids were like quicksilver in their ability to dart into the line of fire. The two guys from Santa Muerte were 5 paces away now, so intently focused on what they'd figured out had to be Callahan's booth that they didn't bother to look behind them. The taller one was now in the lead. Caruso picked up his speed, closing the distance in moments. He could sweep his jacket, draw, and fire 2 rounds from the Glock in a hair under 1 second. But the men were both armed and stacked one in front of the other. He'd have to shoot more than twice, and those would have to be headshots. Caruso's hand closed around the grip of his Glock when the tall guy and flat nose were 4 steps from the booth. He shouted, "FBI!" at exactly the same moment a teenage boy to his right slid into the aisle to block his path. The Santa Muerte soldiers spun, dragging pistols from under their shirts. Caruso grabbed the teenager with his left hand and shoved him sideways out of the line of fire while he brought the Glock up. The startled kid had no idea what was going on and fought back, infuriated that Caruso would lay hands on him. He grabbed at the table in an effort to push himself up, screaming bloody murder. Caruso pulled the gun back to keep the kid from knocking it out of his hand, or accidentally eating the barrel. Chapter 36. Bonnie Picaro had just taken a bite of her medium-rare ribeye when she heard what sounded like a very angry man in the aisle behind her booth. A petite blonde woman in her mid-60s, she had grown up in Harlingen, which was just about as close as one could get to Mexico and still be in Texas. She hadn't been back to her hometown in more than 20 years, but she still understood enough Spanish to know what a man behind her had whispered. "Time to kill the whore." That just wasn't something good men said, even if they were joking. The slurred tone of his gravel voice told Bonnie this man was deadly serious. Her husband Mike sat across from her. He started to say something, but she raised her hand, shushing him. They'd been married more than 4 decades, and he knew all too well when she was serious. At the same time, Bonnie Picaro reached beneath the table with her right hand and drew a stainless steel Kimber K6S 357 revolver from a simple pancake holster under her vest. The vest was stylish, lightweight cotton and suited a woman of her age. It also did a nice job of hiding her sidearm, which she was seldom without. Bonnie had done her research, quizzing her nephew, who was a detective with the Dallas PD, and watching dozens of videos of different models on the Hickok 45 YouTube channel. This was the first gun and holster she'd ever owned. Bonnie wasn't a gun nut, any more than a person who needed a pickup and bought one for a certain purpose was a truck fanatic. She did not concern herself with all the fancy gadgets and gizmos in the firearms culture. Still, she was practical and went to the range with her girlfriends once a month, religiously presenting the weapon the same way each time she took it out of the holster at night as her instructor had taught her. The little Kimber was